Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is overseas for the screening of a controversial film he made for the BBC 40 years ago about the Sydney Opera House. It was willfully destroyed, but has since been resurrected. Despite his absence, we have a terrific lineup for you today. We start with Mehdi Samati from Northern Illinois University on Iranian-US relations and the recent standoff at the UN. Then we turn to Mexico, where freelance reporter and photographer Jennifer Collins gives us the scoop on attempts to reform the Mexican economy and resistance to such initiatives. And we finish up with Alan Tomlinson of the University of Brighton, who takes us on a tour of the World Cup, its triumphs and its travails. Joining us now is Mehdi Samati, a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University. He's the author of several books, including Media, Culture and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. His research interests include international and global communication, cultural politics of globalization, race and media cultures, and Iranian media and culture. Welcome to the program, Mehdi Samati.
Thank you very much.
It's great to speak with you. Well, there's so much to talk about, but I'd like to begin, if I could, by asking you what's happening right now in U.S.-Iranian relations in the light of what went on or didn't go on at the United Nations?
Right now the Iranian delegation in Geneva are talking to the European delegation and the United States, the so-called 5+1, and that includes United States, UK, Russia, France, China, and Germany. And this comes after the visit by the new Iranian president, and he was here in the U.S., and he was on what was billed as a charm offensive by Western media, and he appeared to say all the right things, and he offered to essentially restart the negotiations with the West over Iranian nuclear activities. And from what I just read, in fact, the press reported on the meeting that they had, and the European foreign policy chief had characterized this latest round of talks as fruitful and forward-looking, and other press outlets have characterized the talks as serious and substantive. And the Iranian foreign minister was very positive. All in all, it appears that things are going well in Geneva. The Iranian foreign minister yesterday had a presentation in which basically offered a roadmap of a sort for moving forward. Iran has claimed that it wishes to resolve the issue within a year time frame, and the West is eager to test that position, and it appears so far that things are going well, and I haven't heard anybody saying that so far. The usual detractors have been quite muted about what's happening right now. So things are looking good.
In terms of Mr. Rouhani, how do you regard his presidency? For many in the West, he's seen as comparatively liberal and the kind of person that so-called liberal capitalist Democrats can talk to.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you are aware, after 8 years of presidency by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, a disastrous 8 years, I might add, and many would agree with that, he came to the office with a rather large mandate. He won without going to the runoff, the first round, and he's been basically promoting a platform of moderation and rational governance, and that kind of rhetoric. He is a Western educated. He has a PhD in law from Scotland, I believe. And he is not the usual type of, reformer politician in Iran, in the sense that he has deep ties to the entire political system in Iran. He comes from deep within that system, and for him to take up the mantle of, you know, reform and essentially reversing of several years of belligerency of the previous president is rather remarkable in the sense that he is an insider. So, and he has the backing of the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, and he has signaled in different ways that he has his, you know, he has the backing of the supreme leader. And in fact, when he returned to Iran, one would have expected after the phone call he had with the president of the United States, and that shook up, because this was the first in since the Islamic since the revolution of 1979, it shook up many also conservatives in Iran. But by and large, the responses, you know, were, even by this also conservatives, muted, and 230 members of parliament of Majlis in Iran signed a letter of support. And this is a parliament that's dominated by conservatives. So it looks like he has the mandate, and he has the right temperament, and it looks like rhetoric and even the kind of mindset that would take to essentially compromise or do a deal with the West,
yeah,
where basically parties could accept each other's coexistence.
So what this suggests, Mehdi Samati, is that given that he is the consummate insider, even as he's a very cosmopolitan international person, the elites, both on the religious and the political side, if I can divide them in that way, have had enough of the effect of both the rhetoric and conduct of Ahmadinejad, but also of the way that the sanctions have hurt the Iranian economy. Would you agree with that reading, or would you give us a different account?
Actually, I would take a different, I would suggest a different, you know, reading of the Iranian situation. I mean, those who have been promoting the sanctions are reading Rouhani's position and the position of the supreme leader as basically the positive effect of the sanctions. But a contrarian view would say that if we look at the current situation and say that Iran doesn't have time on its side because of the economic hardship, that would be, I think, you know, that would be a mistake. You know, Iranian economy has been hurt. Yes, it has been mismanaged more than anything else. But, you know, in comparing Iran and the economic growth, basically, we had an economic activity that declined by, you know, somewhere along the line of 2.9%. Unemployment is high, but compared to, say, Greece and Spain, is not bad. If we were to look at, let's say, you know, per capita income in Iran, let's say 30% below Turkey, but 50% above Egypt, you know, it's not as dire as others make it out to be. In fact, well, at least it cannot be used as, you know, the only, as a leverage to sort of deny Rouhani and his supporters this diplomatic window. I don't think the West does not have, in my judgment, the West does not have time on its side. Iran does. Because if under those severe sanctions, Iran can maintain this level of, you know, economic activity, yes, the Iranian currency has collapsed, but that does not mean the collapse of an economic system, especially now that we have a business-friendly administration, especially now that we have an economic team advising President Rouhani. These are fairly competent individuals and professionals, bureaucrats. They probably will, you know, Iran will pull through, you know, but so we shouldn't read the willingness to negotiate with the West as an imminent sign of the collapse of an economic system. That would be wrong. Yes, we could say that those sanctions have been, you know, hurting Iranian economy, but more than anything else, you know, the pressure has been on probably ordinary Iranians more than on the political system in Iran. So we should look for other reasons as to why Rouhani, you know, and Supreme Leader would, you know, come to the negotiating table.
I'm speaking with Mehdi Samati, professor in communication at Northern Illinois University and the author, amongst others, of the book Media, Culture and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. Mehdi, what do you think are the principal reasons then why the Supreme Leader and President Rouhani are putting out this hand of, shall we say, friendship?
There are a confluence of reasons and motivations. One would be the easing of, you know, this, you know, sanctions. That's one factor. But I think, you know, it's probably wiser to look at the overall strategic position that the Islamic Republic is occupying in the Middle East and globally. I think they have come to the realization that for at least, if nothing else, for the survival of the, you know, Islamic Republic, for essentially being able to compete with Israel in the region, for being the hegemonic power, you know, bloc. And internally, Iranian population is a very cosmopolitan, you know, population. Their literacy rate is high. Iran, even though the Islamic Republic tries to limit its access to information and outside world, is a very information-rich environment, whether through blogs, satellite television, and other forms of communication with the outside world. The highly literate population has been through quite a bit for the past two decades, shall we say, and the system cannot maintain itself. And I think it's, at the end of the day, it's their strategic interest to pull back from this adversarial relationship that they have with the West. And setting aside the label Islamic, you could explain quite a lot of the kinds of alliances that the Islamic Republic has made, you know, in the past, you know, three decades. We tend to sort of read characterization of Iranian society as, you know, a rogue nation, a totalitarian state. These labels do not explain Iran, and they serve an over, you know, arching ideological, you know, purpose for the West and the enemies of, you know, the Islamic Republic, but they don't really explain Iran. So I think, as you know, at the end of the day, these factors having to address the economic system, trying to maintain forward-looking, you know, a strategic outlook where Iran could compete with Israel and other, you know, regional actors and the United States. These factors better explain than, you know, a simple narrative of the economic system is collapsing in Iran, and that's why they're coming to the negotiating table.
Mehdi, you mentioned there the very rich environment for information in Iran, despite attempts to control it. I wonder if you could speak about that in terms of alternative media use. We might speak later about mainstream media coverage in both nations, but there's been a lot of excitement and rhetoric here in the, in inverted commas, West, about the Green Revolution and about notions of alternative media use in Iran over the last few years. What's your take?
Well, if you are referring to the so-called, say, Twitter revolution in Iran, and even recently talks about, you know, Facebook diplomacy, those tend to be exaggerated. However, it does not mean that Iranian communication technologies are not enabling forms of assembly that the state couldn't control. And so there is, you know, thanks to a highly entrepreneurial sort of spirit by a lot of young people in Iran, there has been this explosion of ISPs, internet service providers, and lots of economic activities around IT in Iran. And so people are connected. I was recently there a couple months ago, and even cell phones these days, anywhere you go, you're not far from a Wi-Fi, you know, a zone, hotspot, and people have Wi-Fi generators, you know, in ways that I hadn't, you know, seen before. And I use my iPhone with few apps to connect to, you know, talk to and actually chat using various apps, you know, with colleagues, friends, and family in Iran. So we heard quite a bit of rhetoric, and we saw a lot of excitement about Twitter in Iran. But I think it's the infrastructure in Iran that allows Iranians to bypass any attempts at censorship. And generally, this outlook that Iranians have, and that's been in the making ever since the middle of the 1990s, where people are, you know, not afraid of trying these new gadgets and these technologies. So they have access to technology. The younger people, especially, you know, in Iran right now, we have this a policy of basically, for example, to just give you an example, Facebook and Twitter, you know, as two examples, where the state policy is that, you know, they are not banning access to these, you know, it's not against the law to have a Facebook account. But Facebook is being filtered in Iran. What makes access to it illegal is a use of, you know, a filtering or anti-filtering software. So it's a weird system where, you know, Iranian foreign minister has a Facebook page and he communicates, you know, they have, the president of Iran has a Twitter account, but then the population itself is not allowed to use it directly. But then people use anti-filtering software. And what was interesting recently is that the president of Twitter asked President Rouhani of Iran in a tweet that, will your nation be able to soon, you know, enjoy this service that we offer? And his response was that, I'm working on it, basically. So we have these, you know, it's a context where the infrastructure is there, and there are conflicting attitudes and laws about these technologies, but people have access to them.
Mehdi Zamati, we're going to have to wind up there. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Mehdi Zamati is a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University. His books include Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. We'll take a break for station identification and then be back with Jennifer Collins talking about attempts to reform the Mexican economy. Welcome back. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Jennifer Collins, a photographer and freelance journalist, previously a reporter for National Public Radio's Marketplace, and she's based in Mexico City. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Collins.
Thank you.
It's great to be with you. What I wanted to ask you about, Jennifer, is something that's been, I guess, on my mind for some time now, partly as a former resident of Mexico City, and that is the way in which the country is being written up in the international bourgeois media. If I turn to The Economist, which calls itself a newspaper, but we think of as a magazine, if I turn to the Financial Times or The Guardian or the New York Times, there always seems to be a new puff piece about how fantastic the Mexican economy is, how the society is rolling ahead and so on. What's the story behind that, do you think?
Well, the story is changing, I would say, at the moment, because Mexico's economy is not doing so well right now, actually. Latest government statistics show that it's probably going to grow only maybe as much as 2%, probably less than 2% this year. So it's actually kind of, I think the story is sort of developing as we speak. Mexico was sort of looked at last year, especially last year, because its growth was so strong, and its growth was actually better than Brazil, which is sort of the other country that is often compared to. But it's sort of it's slowing down, and there's kind of I think it's there's concern that the country may not be in as good a shape as these puff pieces have been painting it.
And I was fascinated by them in the first place. I take your point about the economy slowing down, but why would suddenly papers of the standing of The Guardian or the FT or New York Times start to build Mexico up? Was there something about the government's intentions to engage in these major reforms that struck journalists there as being of significance? Do you feel as though you're there in a moment when there's big change afoot?
So over the past few years, we have seen some sort of steady growth in Mexico's economy. Near the end of last year, mid last year, we were seeing growth that was, you know, almost 4%, which was better. This is GDP growth. Better than Brazil. Mexico was growing faster than Brazil. So that was a huge moment of optimism. In addition to that, Mexico had an election last year. The new president came in at the very end of last year, Enrique Peña Nieto. And a lot of people saw that as an opportunity as well because he had so many reforms proposed. He's been planning to reform the oil industry in Mexico. And so there was a lot of optimism in the country because of all of these changes that were afoot. However, this year things are kind of not going as well as everybody's expecting. And so so there's a question as to what is going to happen in the future, as well as whether Enrique Peña Nieto is going to get all of his reforms passed.
Now, mentioning those reforms and the positive reception they had urges me to ask you about the negative reception they also received, in particular the oil reforms that were proposed, massive demonstrations. What are they about? Why are they happening and who's involved?
Well, the oil industry in Mexico has basically been sort of under government control since for over 70 years. So Mexico has been in this situation where the oil industry has essentially been run by Pemex, which is this government rather inefficient business that doesn't really operate in a very profitable manner. In fact, it's taken on some serious debts. And so the proposal was to open up the oil industry to some much broader international involvement, potentially some profit sharing and that sort of thing. The problem is that people in Mexico consider oil to be sort of a national treasure, something that Mexicans own, and they don't really want to give it over to international companies. And so there, as you said, there have been massive protests. There's a huge backlash against this reform, and while there's still some serious support for it, there are some questions as to whether it will be passed in the form that Enrique Peña Nieto wants it to be passed in.
And I guess this gets back also to the incarnation of Lázaro Cárdenas in the form of nationalized oil, that part of his great legacy as the president of Mexico all those years ago, as you mentioned, is this notion of a structure of feeling of Mexicanness that is about national ownership of natural resources. Is that fair to say,
right?
Do you think? Yeah. So is it in a sense everyday people in the street who are part of these protests, or is it elites as well?
I just want to go back and say the thing that doesn't get reported enough is the reason that people feel so tied to the oil industry in Mexico Back when Lázaro Cárdenas nationalized the oil industry in Mexico, you know, Mexico had to actually pay for that. And what he did was call Mexicans to give a little bit of their own money to actually help and cover the cost of nationalizing the oil industry. So people back then would bring things like their chickens to help pay for that. So they would like hand over their chickens to like the oil, to the government in order to kind of cover the cost. So it's not just that people think that this is, you know, something that, that, you know, that Mexico owns, you know, they should have control over their own, the oil that's drilled on their land. But also people consider this something that their grandparents, you know, paid for with, you know, the their own livestock, their chickens, you know. It's very, it's more than just a trite thing to say that this is something that's a national treasure. It really is, to many people on the ground here, it's something that's really near and dear to their hearts. And I think that, yes, you might say that the elite sort of have a little bit less of, you don't feel quite as tied to the oil industry as the people who are sort of, who, you know, actually, whose grandparents actually turned over their chickens. But I think that you could ask people in sort of all levels here in Mexico, and there is some interest in, you know, sort of maintaining control over the oil industry.
Now, in terms of Cárdenas, of course, his son, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, is also a politician, in fact, was robbed of the presidential election in 1988. What's his stance been in public? Has he adopted a stance at all about these reforms?
Oh, yes, he is opposed to the reforms, even though Enrique Peña Nieto was sort of like invoking Lázaro Cárdenas when he proposed these oil reforms and saying that, you know, this isn't much of a change from the vision of Lázaro Cárdenas. Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas has come out very publicly and said that this is not something that is that he supports it in by any stretch.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Collins, who is a photographer and freelance journalist based in Mexico City, previously a reporter for National Public Radio's Marketplace. Jennifer, moving on from oil, one of the other areas that Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president, promised to reform and is seeking to change is education. And this has also led to some serious backlash in the form of populist demonstrations. Can you fill us in on that background as well, please?
Yeah, so a reform has actually been passed in Mexico's education system. The reform would require a number of things, one of them being performance-based evaluations for teachers in Mexico, because many of the teachers, because there's a concern that some teachers inherit their posts or pass their posts on to friends. Their teaching jobs are not come by in any sort of competitive by it. Their teaching jobs are not come by on any sort of competitive grounds. And so you've seen a lot of protests in Mexico City. We've actually had teachers in Mexico City protesting for the past 2 months, maybe even a little bit more. And the protests have been quite, you could say they've been quite disruptive for people here in the city. They've shut down the airport or shut down streets going to the airport. They've shut down a number of streets throughout the city. And so definitely people within Mexico City are not exactly thrilled about it. The latest on this is that one of the sort of dissident factions of the union that was really, you know, actively protesting has sent about 80% of the protesters back to the classroom that was in Oaxaca. And so school has started in Oaxaca, but schools have been closed in parts of the country since they ended last year, or at the end of last school year. So it's been quite a disruptive situation here.
When I was last in Mexico City a couple of months ago, there was street violence, and it was said by the media and the police that in addition to teachers' union representatives involved in some of this, there were anarchists who were, in a sense, jumping in on the opportunity, but no doubt were also impelled by ideological and political commitments. What part have they played, as far as you can tell?
Yeah, it's definitely not just been teachers. There have been students who have been sort of involved in these protests. There have been other sort of more shady, like you mentioned, the anarchist groups that have been involved in the protests. And it seems as though they've sort of ratcheted up kind of the level of or the tension in the protests, I guess you could say. Now, we can't say that it's just a one-sided situation. The government did essentially kick the protesters out of the center part of the city, the Zocalo, right before Independence Day celebrations, and did it using tear gas and high-pressure water and all sorts of other things that have been suggested as well, that there it wasn't necessarily a nonviolent sort of the tactics that the government used weren't entirely nonviolent either. So there is, you know, there is definitely in any story in Mexico, there's always, you know, a few sides. In any story anywhere, there are always a few sides. But this is one of those ones where it gets murkier and murkier the further you dig.
But as a glamorous freelance journalist, do you feel as though there's revolution in the air in Mexico, given what's going on with the oil and education reforms, and given the environment more generally?
That is a hard question to answer, but I would say, to a certain degree, it always feels a little bit like there's revolution in the air in Mexico. People are vocal. They take to the streets. You see protests in Mexico City all the time. But on the flip side, while there are some reforms coming, it's not like they're changing things in such a fundamental way that we're going to see a totally different Mexico. You know, while I think that there is, while we have seen some changes with the education system, we don't know if they're fundamental enough to actually change the education system in Mexico and give people who really need access to good education and can't afford to pay for private schools, we don't know if they're going to get if the teachers are actually going to be, you know, in the classroom like they should be, whereas in Mexico there's a real problem with teacher absenteeism and not, you know, not having substitutes to cover those classes. You know, same thing with the oil industry. There's a potential that things could be changing, but they're sort of held up right now, and we don't know if there's going to be a huge amount of change there either. And I don't know that it's necessarily going to fix the problems with the oil industry, even if, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily going to fix the problems with the oil industry if, you know, international companies come in. It may just be sort of status quo.
And one last question for you, which is, in a sense, the implicit price deflator in any conversation these days of everyday life in Mexico, and that is the narcos, the extraordinary violence throughout much of the country associated with really the relations between the United States and Latin America as, in a sense, either derailed or described by drug use. This is a huge problem in terms of Mexico being an entrepot between other parts of Latin America and the U.S. It's seen whole swathes of the country more or less ungovernable, or at least governed by narcos. What's going on there, and where do you and your friends feel safe to travel these days?
The situation on the ground in Mexico City, I think, is very different from the situation that we've seen sort of in the border states. I don't usually personally allow fear of the narcos to really influence my day-to-day decisions. And most of my friends don't really either. Nonetheless, there are some states where it's a little bit sketchy, and you know, states like Michoacan, which is over on the Pacific side, have been sort of under siege, and people sort of advise you not to go to those kinds of places. Nevertheless, I think that there's been a sense that things are getting a little bit better. Knock on wood, at the sort of very recently in the last few months, but I hesitate to sort of say that things are getting better, because there are always stories of kidnappings and other sort of violence.
Well, Jennifer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Collins, who is a photographer and freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Following a short break for station identification, Alan Tomlinson joins us to talk about the World Cup. Welcome back to the show. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing. Joining us now is Professor Alan Tomlinson, head of research in the Chelsea School at Britain's University of Brighton. His work focuses predominantly on the social history of sport, sociology, and cultural studies. He previously was editor of the journal International Review for the Sociology of Sport. Welcome, Alan Tomlinson.
Hello. Nice to talk to you, Toby. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. Alan, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the World Cup of men's football, and I'm going to call it football instead of soccer, just because I think that's easier for you and me, and maybe even some of our listeners. But if I lapse
indeed,
into soccer...
Yeah, it is easier. You know, we get quite a lot of North American students in Brighton, and I teach a few of them as well at Cambridge, and I'm very used to saying soccer.
Oh, well, if you can say soccer, that makes it all the easier for some of our listeners, maybe most of them.
Yeah.
Alan, this World Cup is coming up next year. Just this week, we've seen a number of final qualification matches, and in fact, the USA has qualified for the finals, which will be next year in Brazil. I wanted to ask you about some of the controversies surrounding the World Cup. And I know you're an expert on this going way, way back. Let's talk about FIFA, the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, and it's the governing body internationally, and various charges of corruption that surround it, and in particular some of the folks involved in the Americas. What's the story there with FIFA?
The story with FIFA is a fascinating story, from the creation of a body in 1904, comprising seven European nations. Some of those nations were represented by clubs rather than national associations. But seven founding nations, didn't include Britain actually, didn't include any of those British teams for a couple of years, but really trying to standardise the rules so that we could play international sport together. So people wanted to be able to say that soccer could be understood wherever you went to take on some international rival. In Britain, it had happened, obviously, between England, Scotland, Wales, and parts of the islands. What people really wanted was to understand that they had a shared understanding of those rules when they met. It's, and then what was interesting, of course, that was that soccer also got a big grip, not in North America initially, but in the South Americas, in Uruguay in particular, and Argentina, and of course Brazil, where the game is next year. And so in 1916, a federation was founded for South American national associations. And they worked along with FIFA, the world body, because the European group called itself the world body.
Very modest.
Quite a number of years, yeah. And the first, what happened was a lot of arguing between bits of the emerging world, the established European nations and so on. And then FIFA really got quite big once it established this Men's Football World Cup, Toby, in 1930, when the French boss of FIFA didn't really have any offers locally in Europe, and he encouraged the Uruguayans, who were top team, double Olympic champions, to stage the first World Cup, and only four nations from Europe managed to get there in 1930, and Uruguay won it. Now, the interesting thing about this, of course, is that it's an incremental growth in terms of global significance and reach of what FIFA did and does. And in the 30s, it was in a way it was grabbed by fascism, by Mussolini and Italy. Double Men's World Cup champions in the 30s was Italy under Mussolini. But increasingly in the post-colonial period and the post-World War II period and the establishing of these other continental federations, including one for North and Central Americas, it's obviously become a very, very big deal, and it's become the World Men's World Cup has become FIFA's highly dependable cash cow because of how much it now attracts in revenue from broadcasters and sponsors.
So, from fairly modest beginnings as an attempt to standardise rules and set up an international competition, it's become one of the most significant parts of civil society around the world. The question is, when you get cash, normally, in my experience, you also get corruption. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, you do. I mean, and it happens at times, you know, as soon as the cash arrives, quite early. So one of the top first, not presidents, but top, what we now call a CEO, a chief of the FIFA admin, however tiny it was in the early 30s, ran off with a kitty at one point in the early 30s, and that was kind of hushed up, and he was nudged aside, and then FIFA was moved over. But these were not huge sums then. Once in the 1980s, when certain other things were going on in sport, of course, whether it was IMG and International Management Group and in the States and golf and some other sports. But really in the 80s, what really took off was the new golden triangle of the sports event, the international satellite-driven broadcasters, and the professional marketing people who moved in to work on deals and broadcasting. And when some people saw quite what the scale of rewards and personal aggrandizement could be in the 1980s, particularly through the man who ran Adidas then, Horst Dassler, it really became a matter of deal-making and an absolute lack of transparency of financial dealings in a new gold rush in terms of global sport.
And, of course, now we've got a situation where we've got a World Cup upcoming in Brazil, in which there have been mass protests across the country against the use of public funds locally to create a World Cup infrastructure when they could be better allocated towards the everyday needs of ordinary people. Now, Brazil is meant to be the most football-mad place in the world. So what's going on there, do you think?
What's going on is some kind of strange, it's not a collusion, but some strange compromise between, or a balance between the passion for the game, and in a place like Brazil, it is such a huge, huge passion, the game, and having won the World Cup, not in 1950, but in 58, and then after that become the main winner of the men's soccer World Cup, that passion is entrenched. But at the same time, people have become more and more aware of how some of the FIFA people, you know, the people who come into FIFA on committees, some of the people who run FIFA, such as the current President Sepp Blatter, his predecessor, a Brazilian, Joao Havelange, people become more aware of quite how much these people are taking for themselves and creating extraordinary lifestyles of luxury with an unaccountability thrown in as well from their life. So people are becoming aware of this more and more. So the contradiction between the passion of the game and critique of what the game is being used for by others, you know, at certain times it was governments, and way we've just been discussing it, it was not just governments, but it's self-aggrandizing entrepreneurs. So people are saying, excuse me, hold on, we're not accepting the old bread and circuses argument anymore. And in Brazil, this is what really, really happened earlier this year at the Confederations Cup, which was the kind of rehearsal for the men's soccer finals of the World Cup next summer, that some people went out, Pelé went out and said, look, you know, play the game. And the game is what counts. Don't worry about the infrastructure of your society. And he was taken by real surprise, Toby, because people said, excuse me, including players in the national side, the people have a point here. If so much money is flowing into FIFA, how come the nation, comparable to the Olympics at times as well, the nation has to pay so much itself to make these things happen?
I'm speaking with Professor Alan Tomlinson, Head of Research in the Chelsea School at Britain's University of Brighton. We're talking about the Men's World Cup of Soccer/Football, which has its big finale in Brazil next year. Alan, I wonder if I could also ask you about some controversial decisions for future locations of World Cup finals, particularly in Qatar, where we're talking about, in Fahrenheit, 120-degree weather for football matches and for fans. What's that all about?
Well, it's about at least two things. Yeah, one is that FIFA has managed to stick to a mission across different historical epochs. Its mission is to expand the game, what we'd call is globalise the game, say that soccer, among other team sports, is good for people, it's good for character building, it can be linked to all sorts of forms of intercultural understanding, and it's been able to sell that same message throughout and strengthen that message by saying, excuse me, it shouldn't always be in the areas of the world that are already the richest ones, the most privileged ones, and therefore it's fantastic to have a World Cup in, you know, Asia, again an Olympics comparison with South Korea in 1988. And so to say we've had a World Cup in Africa, the first one in Africa, South Africa in 2010, and then back to Brazil, in a way, because it's been there once before, but then to say, actually, we're not going to go back to England, stroke Britain, or the US, or Australia. We're going to go to parts of the world we've not been to before. Yeah. So you can carry the argument that actually having the first ever soccer World Cup for men, the full World Cup, they've had under-17s and for practices for a long time in certain Gulf states, but to say that we're taking it there fulfills its global mission. Of course, these things don't happen very quickly, and since societies like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates hit oil, and became extraordinarily rich, and that could change the prospects of their theocratic structures and their ruling dynasties. Sport has been seen by such societies as an extraordinarily useful means of what we all now call soft power, following Joseph Nye. We'll do all this for sport. Come and have a great time here, and don't ask us questions about whatever it is, democratic rights, homosexual rights, citizen rights, gender rights, or what have you. And so something very interesting is happening there, because FIFA can continue to sell its message despite the fact that those who are really playing into that message stand for the very opposite of what its big message is in terms of peace, understanding and equality and democracy.
We've also seen horrendous revelations in the last month of death and appalling working conditions, living conditions, if one can even call them that, for the migrant workers who are building the infrastructure of the World Cup in Qatar, haven't we?
Yeah, that is tragic. I mean, what worries you most, more than anything, is that actually those sorts of practices, when you see them revealed, it also reveals them as quite normal, actually, but not usually covered, and the kind of labouring, the mobility of cheap labour in societies like Qatar and the UAE and elsewhere is frightening. And of course, what people immediately say is, well, sorry, these are aberrations, we will clear it up, we don't want that or anything like that. But of course, the very fact that those sorts of forms of exploitation were happening is revealing in itself.
Is FIFA, in fact, now a corporation rather than a non-government organisation? Is it really there, effectively,
well,
to make money?
It acts in some ways. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, Toby, in the hierarchy since the early to mid-1990s about this. And Yao Havelange, the Brazilian, with his deals with Coca-Cola, most of them orchestrated by Sepp Blatter, the current president, is been employed by FIFA since 1975, when he was first brought into the organisation. They've brought in money, they've survived certain crises, the bankruptcy of certain partners and this, that, the other, but they've managed to operate a business model, but remain in Switzerland, of course, where there are a lot of privileges, tax privileges, the bank secret privileges and so on. It's infamously the country that harbored Nazi gold for many, many, many decades. They've managed to claim, despite all that kind of huge expansion of revenue, never called profits actually, forms of surplus, to keep selling the message and keep the status in Switzerland of essentially a charity, a non-profit-making activity. And the question there is whether, in fact, that level of hypocrisy ought to be tolerated for much longer.
Now, we've mentioned a couple of times in our conversation, Alan, that this is about men's football, men's soccer, which obviously is the glamorous side of FIFA's work. What about women's football, women's soccer? Here in the United States, we've regularly had world champion teams, and it's certainly a popular spectator as well as participant sport. Where does women's football stand in the FIFA galaxy?
Well, again, FIFA has taken it on, which is important. I mean, FIFA backs it with certain resources, but to take the economic term that I used earlier about the Men's Soccer World Cup being the cash cow, nearly everything else that FIFA offers or supports or stimulates and promotes under its label is essentially a loss leader. And what FIFA gains from supporting the Women's Soccer World Cup is masses of good publicity. because it seems to be breaking some old molds and so on of masculinity domination by men and so on this. But what it does without very much expense at all, really. I mean, the FIFA finances in the high billions remain very, very resistant to any form of transparent understanding, but for a very low cost, they can get a massive amount of publicity for backing the women's game, and then Sepp Blatter quite ridiculously some years ago did say at one point, well, we're doing all we can, but if the women's game perhaps included people wearing women wearing skimpier shorts, they might get more audiences. So there's this clown-like understanding of what the women's game is on one hand, but also an institutional backing for it, which of course has created a fantastic market, because the encounters between Japan and the USA women's team in soccer in the Olympics and the World Cup have been fantastic in recent years. And at one point they set this, well, a world record that's always going to be exceeded, isn't it, month by month, but the world record for tweets in the last moments of one of those encounters.
Well, thanks very much, Alan Tomlinson. It's been great speaking to you.
Okay, it's very, very good to speak to you. I hope that the West Coast audience is interested in these rather interesting questions about soccer.
We absolutely are. I've been speaking with Professor Alan Tomlinson, Head of Research in the Chelsea School at the University of Brighton. His work focuses predominantly on the social history of sport, sociology and cultural studies, and previously he was editor of the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. He'll be back next Monday. The programme is available at ianmasters.com. I'll return tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Thanks to Graham Fitzgibbon in the soundproof booth for production services, and bye for now. Bye.